This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Carl Eikenberry, who is the William J. Perry Fellow for International Security at Stanford University. He's a retired United States Army Lieutenant General and former commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan and former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. Carl, welcome to Berkeley.
Harry, it's good to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Hammond, Indiana, and raised in the Midwest, and then in my high school years went to Goldsboro, North Carolina.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, my father and mother were part of the Greatest Generation. My father served during the Second World War. So I think that part of the experience of being raised in the home of that generation is the early on getting the idea of commitment to a national service, something much bigger out there than the home or the town that you live in. As well, my father, as I grew up, he went on to manage a lot of different companies and factories around the Midwest and down in North Carolina. And I think I learned a lot from him about management and leadership as well. And from my mother, a very resolute woman that accomplished a lot in a very different time in our country. From her, I think I learned a lot about just toughness and high standards.
And was around the dinner table, was there discussion of world events?
There was. It was the era of Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley. And yes, part of the family ritual was to listen to the evening news, and we would sit down at the dinner table, and my father and mother would, yes, have long discussions about politics and the greater world outside.
And did your father talk to you a lot about the Great War and the battles of that war?
Interestingly, Harry, he did not. But what he would occasionally talk about is vignettes of his life experience in the Army just for the period of the war as a draftee, and then went to officer candidate school and become a combat engineer lieutenant. Talked about the period of the occupation of Japan, but more in positive stories and what a deep, profound influence that experience had on him. Importantly, too, many of his World War II veteran friends, as I was growing up, would occasionally stop by the house and break bread and have dinner together. Yeah, that had a pretty big influence on me as I watched that.
You mentioned your high school. Any teachers there or programs that helped shape you in the direction you undertook?
I was very fortunate. I went to Goldsboro High School in Goldsboro, North Carolina, beginning my sophomore year. We had moved from the state of Wisconsin, and I was to graduate from that school. It was a very traditional public school, huge emphasis on the humanities and social sciences. I had some very tough teachers that I don't know whether I had warm feelings for them in the classroom or when I was struggling with my homework at night. But as I look back on them, they had a real great influence on me in terms of helping me to become more creative, to think about the liberal arts, and to think about social problems in ways that, had I not been through that experience, no, I don't think I'd be the same person.
When did you decide that a military career was for you?
It was well after I had graduated from West Point. My decision to go to West Point was based upon an intrigue with the military, a kind of young fascination with it. That doesn't necessarily end up to a career. Many go to our service academies still today, and after 5 years of obligatory service, they'll elect to leave. I think that the point that I decided that the Army was going to be at least a 20-year career for me. It was several years after I had graduated from West Point. Our military, our Army, was experiencing some real difficult problems in the post-Vietnam War, in the post-Vietnam era. And as I looked at the struggles we were having with ill discipline, with the we were rudderless. I had the good fortune of being selected to serve as a young lieutenant in a very elite unit called the 1st Ranger Battalion that had just been stood up. I had with me the very best non-commissioned officers in the world, a group of extraordinary young soldiers, and I saw through that experience what our Army, what our armed forces could be. And at that point in time, after about 2 years of service, that I told myself there could be a much better future for this Army, and I wanted to stay and be part of that.
It sounds like you were thinking about problems of leadership early in your career.
Well, you know, Harry, yes, but I would tell you that as you go through the Service Academy program and you're commissioned as a young officer, leadership is part of the regimen. Leadership is part of what is trained to and expected of you. You're going to, after commissioning, be put in positions of responsibility over young soldiers. And so leadership is critical to your performance as a officer.
Let's talk a minute about your career at West Point. So what courses really were you drawn to, and one of them was language, right? Was this the point in your career when you studied Mandarin?
It was. How I began to study Mandarin, there's an interesting story behind that, Harry. When I was a senior at West Point, Goldsboro High School, having been accepted to the military academy, I received a letter one day from the head of the Department of Foreign Languages, opened it up, and I was told in this letter that I would have to study 2 years of foreign language at West Point and make my choice. Dating myself, it was the old Mark Sense cards with the number two pencil. And I looked over the list of possibilities, and I saw French was there, but I was studying French in high school. I said, well, that's boring. I don't want to continue that. And I looked on the list and started to get more interested. Then I came to Russian. It was the height of the Cold War. And I said, well, this is very exotic. But even below Russian, there was Mandarin Chinese. At this point, Harry, I'd been to a couple of takeout Chinese food restaurants. That was the depth of my knowledge of China. But as this young senior in Goldsboro High School, again, excited by my faculty to look at the world in different ways, I said, well, this is really exotic. And so I put that down as my first choice. A few of us out there put it down as their first choice that I was able to take Chinese. And I hardly ever looked back after that period of time. So, you know, contingency led me to study Chinese. But once I began it at the military academy, I really fell in love with the language and then subsequently fell in love with the region, that part of the world.
And you did some time abroad studying the language, or was that later?
I was fortunate to be sent with the what we call it the Chinese Language Club going into my junior year at West Point to Taiwan, then nationalist China. And that 3 weeks of immersion there, not only language immersion, but more importantly, cultural immersion, that served to really validate in my mind that I wanted to continue with my study of Mandarin Chinese.
We'll talk about the careers that you've had in diplomacy and the military in a minute, but from your own experience and then the experience of the jobs you've had, I guess you have some pretty pronounced views about what a well-educated soldier looks like, and I have the sense that you really think a broad sense of other cultures and histories is very important.
I do. I think it's important for America writ large to have that firm understanding of the outside world. But when we talk about our armed forces, absolutely vital. Maybe even more important, though, when you look at our armed forces, maybe even more important within our Army and our Marine forces. Why do I say Army and Marine? They're ground forces. We have an expeditionary armed forces. We deploy overseas. We deploy into regions of the world that have different languages, different traditions, different cultures. And so it's not only a question then, as when we deploy somewhere, we have an opposition, but we're operating in environments where the sea that we're operating in, so to speak, is a sea of humanity, foreign humanity, and that in order for us to succeed, it's absolutely essential that we understand the environment that that we're deployed into. And so, yes, if I talk to Army officers, Marine officers, officers of armed forces, I'll strongly encourage them to try to continue to pursue a strong liberal arts, humanities, social science education.
Your career path has exposed you to two very important arms of the instruments of the way we relate to the world, the military and diplomacy. For young people who might be watching the show, I'd be interested to know, what do you see as the skill set and temperament involved in, on the one hand, being a soldier, and on the other hand, being a diplomat?
Yeah, that's a great question. A soldier depends upon what level that we're talking about. Are we talking about at the tactical level? Are we talking about at the strategic level? But at the tactical level, a young leader has to have the ability to form a team of men or women and ultimately to be prepared to go into a combat environment and to get them to do things that sometimes reasonably thinking rational people won't want to do, and that's to put yourself possibly into harm's way to accomplish a mission. As you work your way up in the military side to the strategic level, then the skills that are required do start to change. The need for interpersonal skills to be able to lead, to inspire, those remain the same. But the operating environment that you're in becomes much more complex. And then the need to see the world in terms not just of tactical military problems, but to see a world in all its complexities with the politics, the economics, and understand then what the proper military component of national comprehensive power is. On the diplomatic side, too, there it depends upon when we talk about diplomacy, are we talking about at the most junior levels or are we talking about the senior levels of the Department of State? But a very different part, I think, of diplomacy is that at the more junior levels, you're not leading organizations. You're out there, you're observing, you're analyzing, and you're reporting. And as you work your way up in diplomacy, you do start to lead big organizations. You start to lead embassies. So the management skills do become more important. But the similarity, I think, as you work your way up the ranks, say, of the Department of State and the United States military, is as you reach to the strategic level, then that ability to see the world not just as a diplomat, as the Department of State instructions that you receive lead you to move forward with, but you have to be able to integrate and see all the aspects of national power and then to figure out how your particular piece fits in.
What about temperament in these two very different fields?
I don't know, Harry. I've thought a lot about leadership, watched leadership in action. One of the memorable quotes that I had about leadership came from the great basketball player Michael Jordan, who had been a player coached by both Dean Smith at the University of North Carolina, more quiet in his mannerisms, and coached by Bobby Knight. And when Bobby Knight was an Olympic coach, and Bobby Knight known for his very aggressive style of leadership and coaching. And Michael Jordan was asked a question, compare and contrast those coaches, and his answer was different vocabulary, same results. So I'm not one to say that there's a particular kind of management style, temperament, leadership that can lead to success. But maybe the most important first principles are always show respect for those who work for you, to try to create an environment where teamwork is more important than the performance of the individual, and maybe create that kind of environment, whether it's diplomatic or military, in which you can say that the worst that a subordinate can ever feel, if criticism has to be given, is when they you can look at a subordinate and say, I'm disappointed, without raising your voice. And you've got a good team, I think, when that subordinate takes that as about the worst criticism that can be rendered.
You've had the unique experience of being both the commander of forces in Afghanistan and the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. Both of these were in different periods of the post 9/11 American intervention. As a in both of those roles, what was learning like? I mean, we our commitment varied over time. It was differently resourced and so on. And what helped you learn the most? Was it being in both positions and seeing the war from both sides, or was it going away and then coming back because your tenure there was not continuous?
It was both. I did have three different tours of duty in Afghanistan, my first beginning in 2002, the last ending in 2011. So there's a learning across the continuum of time. You learn more about the critical actors in Afghanistan, maybe about the political actors, the military players there. You learn more about the politics and the culture and the society. And I think over time what that I started to gain from the many years there was a sense of hubris about how much we didn't know, how much I didn't understand, but also maybe more realism about how much could be accomplished on what kind of timeline. We have the expression that if you're looking at a particular plot of vegetables, that pouring more water onto them and adding more fertilizer is good up to a point, at which point you exceed and you destroy the crops. So with more time in Afghanistan, as I started to look at our governance programs, our military programs, that started to make more sense to me, that we had to, as impatient as we could be, we had to self-limit. In terms of the different portfolios, the military portfolio, ambassadorial portfolio, I could see the strengths and weaknesses of both organizations, what the military can bring into a particular problem, what they could bring into Afghanistan is an incredible ability to sit down and to analyze at a moment of time and then to develop a plan to deal with the problem as their analysis told them it was, and then to mobilize extraordinary resources to go after that problem.
And the problem is a military problem.
That as they define the problem.
Yeah.
On the civilian side more limited by not having the resources available, not necessarily bringing to the table a good culture of planning. But on the other hand, on the civilian side, bringing incredible diversity into an environment like Afghanistan with all kinds of skills and disciplines that come to the table, which were really needed as I then looked at my time as ambassador with this group that I had in the United States Embassy from 18 different departments and agencies of the government, the Department of Treasury, Commerce, Agriculture, the Department of State, the CIA, even some military there, and that civilian team that we had, primarily a civilian team, not as constrained in terms of thinking about the problem in terms of a snapshot in time, one particular paradigm, but actually in Afghanistan being in a very dynamic situation where without those kind of constraints, I actually found their analysis over time to probably be better and more comprehensive than the military. There's one other advantage that the civilian team has, but this can become a function of leadership. With that diversity that you've got, all these skills, all of which are needed in a very complex situation as we find ourselves there, still there today, that you have, if you can create a climate in which they all feel they can contribute and argue, and then you can somehow steer that towards a general consensus, that that too can be very powerful in terms of the results that you can get, where the military sometimes can get itself locked into a very hierarchical approach and so extraordinarily efficient at, as I said, trying to solve what they've defined the problem as, but at risk always in actually having defined the problem improperly.
Now, over time, we moved to a rationale of I think you called it hardening the state,
right,
of building up the institutions, the rule of law, and so on. And as part of President Obama's military surge, there was a civilian surge also. Now, that required you as ambassador to sort of be creative about how these personnel would be deployed. Talk about that. Was there an opportunity then to try something different as you had more of these civilian employees on the ground and then relating to the military operation?
Yeah, we did some innovation, Harry. I think actually we did a lot of innovation. Some of it worked out well. Some of it did not work out all so well. Probably our biggest innovation that I think was successful in to respond to your question about how did we rethink civilian-military relations was to create what we called unity of civilian effort. And what do I mean by that? When I became the ambassador in Afghanistan, we did have civilians from the Department of State, Agriculture, and USAID, our development agency, spread out through around Afghanistan. But they were generally in positions where they were acting as advisors to senior military commanders who were in their area. So when the president then ordered the surge and I went off to Afghanistan as the ambassador, I thought it was important if we were really going to have an equal civil-military relationship that I would reorganize our civilian effort in terms of its hierarchy. And then wherever we had a military command, I would create a civilian counterpart. And that civilian counterpart would no longer be an advisor to the military commander. They'd be a co-equal. We called them senior civilian representatives, but gave them sets of personnel responsibilities for wherever there were then civilians assigned in their area that coincided with their military commander counterpart. They'd have the responsibility for those integrated civilian efforts, and we actually devolved budgetary authorities to them as well. That we had difficulties at times in implementation, but as I look back on that, I think that was a good model, and it's probably a model worthy of replication. Should we have to do something like this again?
At points in this process, is the military arm and the civilian arm sort of coming into conflict and at certain points working at cross purposes? I mean, you can envision a security problem requiring a kind of attack or response that would really alienate the Afghan people from what the civilians are trying to do.
There's that problem that you're talking about a action that might alienate the Afghan people is something, Harry, that in the main, I think that your military and civilian leadership at any level over time, they'll look at the problem about the same. But where they don't necessarily put the same priority or emphasis is in the tension that can exist between emphasis on what you would call security or stability operations versus emphasis on long-term sustainable growth. So what do I mean by that? You can have a military commander that's operating in a particular area, and his absolute priority, of course, is to defeat the insurgents in the area that he's operating in. And so in order to defeat those insurgents and to protect his own troops and protect the civilians that are there with him and the Afghans, he'll do whatever it takes then to stop the shooting. And if one of the ways to help stop the shooting is to take some of that cash that you've got in your pockets and to pass it out to young men to get them to work so they don't pick up a weapon for the insurgent, well, of course, that makes perfect sense. On the other hand, if you're somebody even in that same environment on the civilian side and you're thinking about long-term development, sustainable government, you're actually going to be thinking pretty hard about what's going to be the long-term possible negative consequences of those cash handouts. For instance, maybe you're handing cash out to young men to go do what? To work as subsidized labor for an absentee landlord who is living in Europe, and that absentee landlord, with his rapacious rents that he's charging and misconduct, is part of the reason, indeed, that the Taliban's been successful in the area to begin with. So, you know, a vignette that I offer, or actual one that occurred in many places of Afghanistan, where you can end up with different priorities, understandable why you have different priorities, but trying to get those to be reconciled can be awfully hard work. And yes, there's a tension that can be out there that we saw in Afghanistan, I know existed in Iraq, that can end up, if you're not careful, working at cross purposes.
When you look at the continuity here of our intervention, there seems to be so much going on. We're learning about the situation. For example, there's an evolving realization of the Pakistani territories where there's movement across borders. Learning about the skill set and corruption and other problems with the institution there. There is the whole problem of inertia. You know, we're there, so we stay, we surge, and so on. So talk a little about this period when President Obama has to make this critical decision whether to surge with 40,000 troops or not. And you were involved in that process. And so was your ability to look at the problems from all these dimensions helpful for you to be in a position to stop the inertia of the process and to really advocate a position of transition, thinking about leaving?
Yeah, I think that a couple of points about the president's decision to commit additional forces into Afghanistan. Number one is that I was very impressed with how the president ran the process. Very deliberative, very open, encouraged all opinions to be brought to the table. If you had something important to say, he wanted it said. And he had his sleeves rolled up throughout this process. And that was appropriate, too. I don't think a president can make any more important decision than to commit U.S. military forces into a combat. And this was going to be at a huge fiscal cost as well. So I was impressed and actually quite proud to participate in the deliberations. The second point here is that it was, I think, clear to everyone at the table, military, civilian, those who were relatively new to Afghanistan, those that had been there before, that the military situation had deteriorated and that it was not a question of committing more troops. It was how many more and to what purpose. And then the third point is that as the president led the discussions before he made his final decisions, there was also great concern around the table, and I think shared both by the military and the civilian teams, that the risk of putting more into Afghanistan was that we might end up then with an open-ended commitment to the Afghans, an open-ended political commitment, and it might be very hard to ever extricate ourselves. And so when the president then made his decision that he would order additional U.S. troops and civilians to surge into Afghanistan. He also delineated at the same time a clear point on the calendar, the summer of 2011, a year and a half after he ordered the surge, in which the surge forces would start to come out. So with that decision, then, he had made very clear that there was a time limit that was going to be associated with this very robust military-civilian commitment to Afghanistan. Did I have an opportunity to play a role in that decision-making, and was the role that I played influenced by my experiences in Afghanistan? I don't know. You know, let historians judge how the final decisions were made. What I will say is that I feel absolutely I had a chance to contribute to the discussions. I don't know what difference I might have made.
After the Vietnam War, there emerged a way of thinking about massive U.S. interventions with large number of troops, and that was the Powell Doctrine.
Yes.
In situations like Afghanistan, where we've gotten in incrementally but with not as large a force, the time comes, as you've just discussed, to transition out. Do we need a new doctrine about how you do that, and what are your thoughts there? By that I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to abandon our troops that are there and the commitment that they have made over time. So you've got to validate that process. On the other hand, you're racing to build up the indigenous institutions and with varying degrees of success. So how do we think about this problem set, which we're going through now in Afghanistan? And is it an argument for not intervening as much or being very cautious about intervening? But once we do, this problem probably will arise again.
The problems here are twofold. You mentioned the Powell Doctrine, preceded before by the Weinberger Doctrine, which is the Weinberger Doctrine of the mid-80s, and then taken forward by Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Powell, influenced very much by the Vietnam experience, where we had drifted off to a war mission creep. That's where the expression mission creep begins, and we got ourselves into a quagmire. The idea about the Weinberger and the Powell Doctrine is well-defined political mission, not a transition, but going in and then a reassessment as you move forward. What are politically we're trying to accomplish? In the absence of political clarity, then the military can wander, and that's where the expression mission creep can begin. So in order to get someplace, you have to know where you're going. And I think that was the critical part about the Powell Doctrine, and then other aspects as well. Given then political clarity, are the necessary means going to be made available in order to reasonably accomplish that mission, and other adjuncts to it as well? Is the mission explained to the American people? Not really the military's role, but a military concern that is there going to be lasting political support for the mission that the military is being committed to? So I think that this is one aspect of need for more introspection by our political and our military leadership based upon the experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, how we went off to Afghanistan, but over a one-decade period seemed to get lost along the way about what we were trying to achieve. And in the case of Iraq, we went off to a war that we didn't really have to engage in. That, when we talk about the Powell Doctrine, is something that does need to, I think, be looked at again by our political and military leadership. The second is that the need for America to try to figure out in today's world, are the sets of commitments that we have globally in terms of security commitments, what we elect to do and not do, are they aligned with the ways and means that are available? I believe that if you look back over our history since the end of the Second World War, we have Presidents Eisenhower and President Nixon come into office, and they find that our country is overcommitted globally, and they try to find ways to redress that. How do you redress that? Through, you can pull back from certain commitments, you can try to formulate new alliances, you can try new strategies. I think that's precisely what President Obama has done since he came into office in 2009. I think he looked at the world, he looked at our fiscal problems that we've got, he looked at the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and said that we need to perhaps have a rebalancing here globally between what are identified as our vital commitments that we'll keep, and we've got to bring these into line, especially with the means available, which right now are not as robust as they were several decades ago, and hopefully they will be again one day.
As you think about this problem of future intervention and the role of the military, I want to talk a little about this very informative and insightful article you published recently about the volunteer army. Two of the points struck me as very interesting. One is the lack of increasingly of accountability both within the military and outside of the military. First, let's talk about the political watchman of the military. And I think what you're arguing is that the Congress has, in a way, abdicated its role of watching the military, not in a malicious way, but just that this has evolved over time, and so that there's not a check on the military as there is often on the civilian components of our policy. You talk about congressmen visiting in Afghanistan and wanting their pictures taken with the officers and the soldiers on the one hand, but on the other hand being very critical of the civilian mission and the people in his mind. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, I think that there's worrisome trends that we've seen since the inception of the all-volunteer force in 1973, where we see our legislature less knowledgeable about our armed forces and, frankly, not as demanding in terms of accountability, much more willing to take a pass, so to speak, in its deployments overseas and into combat operations. You know, here I've get around the country and talk to all kinds of audiences. And it's interesting when I ask a question to the audience that if we still had a draft army today and it was good enough to do what we've tried to do over the last decade, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. Believe me, I know that's a heroic assumption. This all-volunteer force is awfully good right now, and I'm not sure you could get a conscript force near as good as this is. But let's say it was good enough. I ask the question, if we had a conscript force 10 years after our initial intervention in Afghanistan, would we have 100,000 troops there? Not a hand goes up, Harry. And then I'll ask this question, would we even have invaded Iraq in 2003? And usually not a hand goes up. So, yes, is there a connection then between how our Congress thinks about our armed forces and the fact that now it's all volunteer, that it's really off on its own with a lot of its traditional bonds with American society having been broken? That's clearly a factor. If I'd ask another question of these audiences and say, let me give you a statistic here or a story from Afghanistan that over the last 18 months we've had over 50 soldiers, say, or airmen, Marines murdered by their Afghan army and police allies. If this was a conscript army, would we have had congressional hearings about this? And everyone says, of course. But the fact is that we've had no congressional hearings with an all-volunteer force. So I am concerned that there's this army, this all-volunteer force, magnificent as it is, it's become Washington's force. It's not the American people's force. And that our Congress, without then having appeals from the American people to them about the performance and the utilization of that armed force has actually started to lose some interest, and that's worrisome.
You make an additional point, which is a notion developed over time that so much technology and initiative is in the hands of the soldier at the tactical level. I think the term is strategic corporal. That on the one hand, there's a positive side to that with the technology and the initiative, but on the other hand, the tactics become disassociated from the strategy, if there is one. Talk a little about that, because we're going to have more and more technology which distance the soldier from the command structure, and how does that play out?
Yeah, the concept of the strategic corporal goes back to the late 1990s, and the commandant of the Marine Corps of that time, Charles Krulak, wrote a essay about the strategic corporal, talked about the world changing with technologies, with communications having evolved so rapidly that we'd reached a point where a young corporal, so to speak, that 23-year-old very junior leader in the Marines or the Army, whether in the Balkans, Iraq, or Afghanistan, could do something very positive that could make a big contribution to the overall effort, but more frankly, could make a serious error that would go viral on CNN, call it a horrible mistake in terms of causing civilian casualties, an act of misconduct used by our enemies, spread over CNN and BBC that would set our overall campaign back. He talked about that in the late 1990s, and that was prescient. As we look at the wars of the last decade, we've seen where particular mistakes at grassroots level, what would cause grassroots level, seized upon by our enemies and used then to vilify the overall American effort. My concern here is that we have military commanders who work very hard to try to avoid those bad outcomes, but we get ourselves into conflicts where, since people are people and they're not machines, you, of course, in the stress of combat and just humans making mistakes, you can't guarantee that those errors won't be made. Now, if you're in a conflict in which those errors can cause then strategic setbacks, then I think it's incumbent upon those senior military commanders, when they're talking to their civilian leaders, to say, "Mr. President, I'm going to recommend this way ahead in Afghanistan or Iraq, but let me be clear that there's some risk that's going to go with this, because we're going to have a few spectacular failures on the strategic corporal front. So, Mr. President, are you willing to accept that risk?" And if the president says, "No, I'm not willing to accept that risk," then the commander to say, "Well, I'll underwrite that risk. I'll be the first to resign when something goes wrong. I'm in charge." Or if the president says, "No, I just don't want to pursue that that way," then the military's got to come back with a very different plan. I don't think that the military has been explicit enough with our civilian leadership about that kind of risk. And frankly, when things have gone wrong, I think there's been occasions where they've not stood up and said, "This happened on my watch, and since I'm a strategic commander, then when my so-called strategic corporal makes a mistake, that's my responsibility, and here's my resignation."
As somebody who has been on the ground in both the embassy and in the military command post, you've been, you know, where the tire hits the road. I would like a comment from you about the political dynamics at home. And it would seem to be a cause of concern. You point out in the article the whole failure of the media to be critical about our wars. the fact that former officers are often hired as consultants. A lot of the work is being done by military contractors. So what we're missing from the public arena is a critical, helpful perspective on, you know, what we're doing militarily, because we have other instruments of power. And then finally, in the case of winding down in Afghanistan, we can't ignore the political dynamics at home of the president not just weighing what's happening on the ground, but also having to weigh the political implications of whatever decision he makes. So all in all, it's a cacophony of voices that really kind of work against a rational solution when we're intervening, you know, with open democratic discussion.
Yeah, Harry, I think you framed the problem well. That it requires that in Washington, that, as I had said earlier, the political objectives are well stated, and Washington, in the implementation of these very difficult campaigns, as we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan, also needs to wade in occasionally to the into the interagency military discussions that are taking place, and to occasionally arbitrate. That easy to say from Washington, D.C., well, we've put somebody in charge of the embassy, the military, and the CIA who are experienced, and they're what they're expected to do is to get along out there in the field and arbitrate among themselves. And that can be an abrogation of responsibility, because the fact is that sometimes the three, it's not a question of getting along, it's a question of trying to figure out ultimately what is the priority. To be specific, in the case of Afghanistan, if you're the head of the CIA team out there, your job is to kill or capture Osama bin Laden, which we did. Your job is to keep America safe by continuing to dismantle al-Qaeda, and you need Afghanistan as a base of operations to do that. If you're the military commander, your job is to provide security for Afghanistan, build an Afghan army, and fight and push back Taliban. If you're the United States ambassador, your priority is to build accountable governance. You can have success against al-Qaeda. You can have success against the Taliban. But where are we going to be 10 years from now if you don't have a functioning government and some kind of economy? So those are three very, very different problems. And the need for Washington then to, as I said, to look at a distance, hear the different voices, and then give guidance about where are the trade-offs going to be made. These are not campaigns like the Second World War, where Eisenhower is told as he gets to England, your job's to invade the to land on the continent of Europe and march towards Berlin, and you are given the necessary resources to go about this, and great delegations of power. In the case of a very complex campaign, as we have in Afghanistan, there is no Berlin, and it's dynamic. And so especially the way technologies and communications are today, where everybody from the field can go back to their own bosses in Washington, D.C., the need to rethink through then how much gets delegated out to the field, how much has to be retained in Washington, D.C., not for micromanagement, not for Washington, D.C., as LBJ apparently did, decide what targets to drop bombs on, but as I said, how to integrate the policy and where are the prioritizations going to be made.
Part of the transition out of Afghanistan has come together with a pivot toward Asia. As you were completing your education, you learned Mandarin. You've done graduate work in Chinese military history. We are in a situation where One power, China is in a relative rise vis-a-vis its own past and vis-a-vis the other great powers, and the U.S. is in a relative decline, if not absolute decline. So the question becomes, what is the role of the military, you know, in both of these situations? That is, how do you see China using its military, developing its military on the one hand? How do you see us responding to their rise on the other?
Yeah, the rise of Chinese military power is now it's an inevitable byproduct of the rise of their economy. China's rise in their share of the global GDP over the last three decades has been absolutely extraordinary. And if its economy continues to rise even at slower rates than it is right now, if it gets down to an anemic 6%, by the year 2025, most economists estimate that China will have the number one economy in the world. This will be the first time in several hundred years that the largest economy of the world was not to be found in the West. So as China's economy grows, its interests grow. As its global interests grow, then it's going to develop a military that has the capabilities to defend those interests. And that's the path of that's the trajectory of all great powers through history. So as the British commercial interests grew, their military came in behind it to defend those interests. That's the history of the United States of America. So we should not necessarily be surprised that Chinese military power is growing. The question is, what do they intend to do with it? Here, there's reasons for optimism. There's reasons for concern. The reason for optimism, I've seen it over my career, is that still China today remains very committed to being a player in the global economic system and increasingly in the global diplomatic system, so to speak. They're invested in the institutions which we created after the Second World War and has led to more peace and prosperity than not. So people, when they talk about China rising, they'll say this is Athens and Sparta, this is the Peloponnesian War all over again. Well, maybe not. Athens and Sparta maintained two very different alliance structures and two very different trading systems. The Chinese still today see great advantage in integration. They're benefiting from the system. And if you look at China and the United States today in terms of our economic interaction, if nothing else, if we should have a real serious conflict, this would be mutually assured economic destruction between the two sides. At the same time, we do need to keep an eye on the rise of Chinese military power. They have a set of sovereignty claims, territorial disputes that are unresolved. Several of those, most of them concern good friends and allies of ours in East and Southeast Asia. And it's not clear to me at this juncture as well about will the Chinese be content to exist peacefully with the United States militarily in terms of the Western Pacific region. They're starting to assert new interest, and can we find a way diplomatically with the Chinese in the next decade or two to accommodate their interests, but for them to recognize that we are an Asian power and historically, at least since the Second World War, have been, and that we have a set of security interests that they need as well to accommodate.
And there's going to be an important role for diplomacy and balancing that doesn't necessarily lead to military conflict.
There is. This is a hard problem for the United States, for China and the world. This trajectory that China's been on with the size and the mass that China has is we haven't seen anything in modern history like this before. This dwarfs in terms of size and speed, say, the rise of Germany, the rise of Japan, the rise of other great powers over the last several hundred years. So we don't have a good historical framework to look back to try to figure out exactly how to manage this. What we can say is that China today, they seem to have created almost an economic kind of hierarchy in Asia. The United States is leading a security hierarchy in Asia, and we need to find a way through diplomacy to try to bring these two together.
Your career was very different in the post 9/11 world, and you've been on the ground. You've seen a lot from wearing different hats. What do you see as the primary lesson that you learned and that we should learn? And then does it apply to whatever new era we're entering?
Yeah, and I'd go back to the what we talked about earlier, that what is most important is clarity of political objectives when we talk about intervention, and that we also have got, I think, to find a better way to connect the American people to that dialogue about intervention, that dialogue would take place always in due course as long as we had a conscript or a draft army. No president of the United States in our history could commit large numbers of American military forces into combat without resorting to a draft. And in order for a draft to work, then, the American people have to be on board. So there's an explanation that goes with this, whether it was Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War talking to the American people, talking to the North about what we were trying to accomplish, trying to bring them along with their understanding, or whether it was Franklin Roosevelt on the eve of the Second World War and throughout the Second World War, trying to explain to the American people again what is this conflict about. So the American people have got to be part of this discussion. I don't know, as long as we maintain the all-volunteer force, how we actually go about and do that. The second is that if we're going to commit America's treasure to foreign conflicts, then here again, I think that the American people at least need to be given a bill for this so they can make their own choices then about as they get their bill for the war in Iraq, as part of the tax computations that they're doing in advance of April 15th, can they see that of this $5,000 check that they're getting to, they're going to have to write to Uncle Sam, that 1,000 of that went to the war in Iraq, and 1,000 goes to Medicare, and 500 is going to Social Security. We've lost that entirely. And so with the deficit spending that's become the norm for Washington, D.C., there's not a lot of accountability that goes with this. But I think that we made some really big mistakes over the last decade as we went off to war to the mantra of as we're going to war, make sure also that you get down to the shopping center, keep on spending, and live a normal life. That's unprecedented in our country. If we're going to go to war, it's a hard decision to make, but make sure the American people know what they're going to have to pay. And there's got to be a better way, but I don't know how to do it, to try to engage the American people in terms of connecting with the men and women that we're sending off into harm's way. Otherwise, if you're not careful, you're heading in a direction where you end up with a mercenary force, and that's not good for the health of the republic.
Well, very good. Thank you very much, Carl, for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Harry. I've enjoyed this.
It was very insightful. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.